I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. The President and First Lady are paying $112,214 in taxes on their adjusted gross income for the year 2012. That's an effective federal income tax rate of 18.4%, a little less than what they paid last year. The White House said the President wants to raise the income tax rate for wealthy Americans like himself by instituting a Buffett rule, ensuring that the rich pay their, quote, fair share. Well, today is tax day, a good time to look at our tax system and to clear up some of the misconceptions about who pays what and where all that money goes. We asked Robertson Williams to join us on Radio Times. He's a tax analyst, also the Saul Price Fellow at the nonpartisan Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He was at the Congressional Budget Office from 1984 through 2006. And Bob Williams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure, Marty.
Have you paid your taxes yet?
I filed last week and sent a big check in, too.
Have you read all, 74,000 pages of our U.S. tax code?
I certainly have not, and I've never even seen 74,000 stacked up. Every time I look at it, it's a digital version. It's a lot easier to parse out pieces of it. It's a very big tax code.
Too big?
Well, in many ways, you could say yes, but part of the problem with the tax code is there are lots of bells and whistles in there to help out particular situations. And one thing about the tax code, the way it's written, it has lots of explanations of why we are where we are. All the changes have been made over the last 100 years since we implemented an income tax, and it has all the other taxes as well.
It is supposed to be, we're talking about the federal income tax, that's supposed to be a progressive tax system. In practice, is it as progressive as it's touted to be?
Well, it is very progressive. It's not the most progressive tax we have. That would go to the income, to the estate tax. That's much more progressive because it only hits the very, very rich. But of all the taxes we've got that are not the on wealth, the income tax is certainly the most progressive. People at the very top end, the top 1%, pay about 21% of their income in individual income tax. People at the very bottom end pay nothing. We know nearly half of Americans don't pay any federal income tax because of all the tax preferences or because of the fact they're just low income.
Well, in fact, I think there is, and I think we learned this last year, kind of a generalized confusion about our tax system, conflating things like the federal income tax with the payroll tax. Can you kind of tease apart the various taxes that we all pay or many of us pay?
Right. At the federal level, the big ones for individuals are the individual income tax, the one we're filing today, the payroll tax, the piece that gets taken out of every paycheck you have to help support Social Security and Medicare. We have federal excise taxes on things like gasoline, tobacco products, alcohol products, airline tickets. Those are just like sales taxes. Those are the main federal taxes. And, of course, we have lots and lots of taxes at the state and local level, property taxes, state sales taxes, state income taxes, and so forth.
You were the person that wrote, I think this was a couple of years ago, June 2009, that 47% of the population pays no income tax. And as we know, that became kind of front and central of the presidential campaign last year. Help us understand what you were saying.
Well, that measure is a very narrow measure. It says how many people actually pay positive income tax to the federal government. We estimate about 46% of people don't pay, about 54% of people do. Of the 46% of people who don't pay income tax for 2012, that's our latest estimate, about half of those people don't pay because their incomes are just very, very low. The standard deduction and personal exemptions zero out their taxable income. They have nothing to be taxed after those basic exclusions, and therefore they pay no tax. The other half, the other 23%, are people who take advantage perfectly legitimately of the various tax breaks we built into the system. We have, for example, the $1,000 per child tax credit for kids under 17. So if you've got two kids in elementary school, you get $2,000 subtracted from your tax bill. If you're a low-income worker, you can collect the earned income tax credits, basically a supplement to low wages for people who are very low income but working. And we like that. It encourages people to work, and it helps supplement income for low-income households. We encourage people to save for retirement. The money you put into your 401k or your IRA, you don't pay tax on it when you put it in. And you do pay tax later on, but you get a break now, and that's to encourage people to save for their retirements. We encourage people to go to college by giving them a tax break on the tuition they pay. So all these various things that are built into the tax system reduce the taxes people pay, and for 23% of us, that's enough to take a positive tax bill and reduce it to zero.
Are you surprised that it became a discussion about makers and takers, to kind of boil it down to two words?
Yeah, that's absolutely a mischaracterization of the conclusion. This is one tax people pay, and a lot of people don't pay the income tax because we're using the income tax as a way to deliver this various social policies, things like encouraging people to go to work and people to save retirement and so forth. There are a lot of other taxes people pay. Of the people that don't pay income tax, two-thirds of them are working and pay payroll taxes to the federal government, the taxes that support Social Security and Medicare. So they're not deadbeats. Of the remaining people, about two-thirds of them are elderly retirees. They've worked all their lives. They're hardly takers. They're folks that worked, contributed to the system, and now they're in retirement, drawing pensions, Social Security, and not paying federal income tax. That's a very, very much a mischaracterization to say these people are all sitting back and doing nothing and collecting benefits.
Do you think, even looking ahead, and this is assuming that the economy begins to grow at a better and a more stable rate, that 47-46% number will go down?
Absolutely. There's no question that it's going to come down as people go back to work, their incomes pick up again. We estimate that by the end of the decade, the percentage paying no tax will drop to about a third. Two-thirds of Americans will be paying income tax, and only one-third won't. Mm-hmm. And again, most of the people not paying then will be people who are either very low income or elderly and retired.
I started with the president and the first lady, what they're paying in federal income taxes, $112,000. It's a lot in taxes, but they have a very good income of, looks like, $608,611 of adjusted gross income. But it is interesting that the president has for some time now called for increasing taxes on the wealthy. Is there a lot of money there to help balance the budget and even add to the federal coffers?
Well, it's certainly the case the wealthy have a lot of money, and they've done very well in recent years. That's been the president's argument ever since he started running for the presidency back in 2007. He is correct in saying that if you look back over the last 30 years or so, the bulk of income gains have accrued to people at the very top. If you ask where did the gains go, most of the gains went to the people in the top 20%. Within that 20%, most of the gains went to people in the top 1%. Within that, most of the gains went to people in the top 0.1%. Mm. So we're much more concentrated income at the very top. And because those people have done so well, the president says, they can afford to pay more taxes. They're the one group that has done very, very well. And he's targeted them ever since he started running for the presidency, going after people with couples with incomes over $250,000, individuals with incomes over $200,000. That's about 2% of the population. The problem is, while they have lots and lots of money, they don't have enough money to solve our fiscal problems. We can't balance the budget just by raising taxes on the rich. A few years ago, Roseanne Altschuler, Katie Lim, and I did a paper called Desperately Seeking Revenue, in which we asked the following question. If you wanted to close half of the deficit by raising taxes on the rich, how much would you have to raise their taxes? And the answer he came up with was you'd raise the top tax rate from 35% to about 90%. That's not going to happen.
We tried that, didn't we?
People would change their behavior a lot, and you wouldn't even get enough revenue at that rate. You'd have to go even higher, and you probably couldn't raise the amount of revenue. So it's just a non-starter to say we're going to focus only on this richest 2%. Yes, they can pay more tax, but they're not going to solve our fiscal problems.
Let me quote something that Joseph Stiglitz had in the New York Times. He wrote, the richest 400 individual taxpayers with an average income of more than $200 million pay less than 20% of their income in taxes, far lower than mere millionaires. He calls them paying less than 20% of their lower than mere millionaires who pay about 25% of their income in taxes. He's saying that they're taxed basically the way people making $200,000 to $500,000.
Well, and there's a reason behind that. There are a couple of reasons. One is people at that income level typically make a lot of money from investments and not from working. And we have a tax system that favors capital gains and dividends, taxes them at a lower rate than it does tax earnings. The top tax rate currently on earned income is not quite 40%. The top tax rate on investment income, capital gains, and dividends is about 20%. Mm-hmm. So if you are very high income and you're getting a lot of your income from those investment sources, you're going to pay a much, much lower rate. But there's a slight adjustment to that. People who've invested are actually getting a lower return on their investments because of other taxes, in particular because of the corporate income tax that reduces the return on their investment. High-income people pay about a 7.5% of their income for corporate income taxes through this indirect lower returns on their investments. In comparison, the rest of us pay less than 2% of our income in corporate income taxes. So it's a bit of an adjustment there. But still, those people do pay a smaller share of their income for income tax than do people with significantly lower incomes. And they don't pay payroll tax on most of that income, which those of us who are working typically pay tax on all of our income.
Is that an argument, then, to treat all income the same? I mean, I realize that's a very very simplified approach to taxes, but would that work, do you think?
I think the problem is we've tried that a couple of times. We did try to tax all income the same way when we first started the income tax back in 1913. That lasted about 10 years, and we started taxing investment income at a lower rate and regular income at a higher rate. That maintained all the way through with a higher rate on ordinary income until 1986. The tax reform 1986, we again made the two rates the same, 28% maximum tax rate on capital gains and dividends and regular income. Everything faced a 28% tax rate. That lasted all 4 years. In 1990, we raised the tax on regular income, subsequently raised it again and lowered the tax on capital gains, and we've got a bigger wedge now than we had 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The reason for lowering rates on investment is to encourage investment and to recognize the fact that this investment income is taxed somewhere else first. There are reasons for taxing capital gains at a lower rate because part of your capital gain is an inflationary gain. Just because the value of the dollar is depreciated and the same nominal dollars on your investment may not represent any increase in gain at all, but you're going to pay tax if there's an inflationary gain. So there's various bits and pieces. I could go on and bore people to death with the details, but there are reasons to have different rates. How big the difference should be, is the way we're doing it the best way? Those are very good questions that would take a lot longer than an hour to answer.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. It is tax day today, April 15th, and we are not taking your individual tax questions, but we're talking about tax policy, where the money goes, how it comes in, who pays, who doesn't. And again, our guest is Bob Williams. He's a tax analyst, the Saul Price Fellow at the Nonpartisan Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
Just You Wait, WHYY's program about popular culture, brings you stories about our changing world, like trying to stop teenagers from ruining their digital lives, practical tips to ready yourself for the end of days, and how we sent one of our reporters to space camp and it nearly killed him. Okay, he just blacked out a little. Still, pretty cool. Those stories and more, Just You Wait.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Nicholas McGeegan leads members of the Philadelphia Orchestra in music of Bach, featuring four acclaimed Brandenburg concertos. Brandenburg tickets are available now at 215-893-1999 or online, philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Bach's Brandenburg Concertos with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking taxes today on Radio Times with our guest, Rob Williams, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bob, picking up on something that you said earlier about our regressive part of our tax system, which are the payroll taxes, explain to our listeners how that ends up being regressive.
Well, let's start off by telling people what regressive and progressive mean.
Fair enough.
A progressive tax is a tax that the higher your income goes, the more, the larger percentage of that income we take in taxes. So a low-income people might pay 10% of income in taxes, a middle-income people 15%, and a high-income person 20%. That's a progressive tax.
Right.
A regressive tax goes the other way around. The higher your income, the lower your tax rate on that income. So a low-income person might pay 15%, a middle-income person 10%, a high-income person 5%. The income tax is progressive. As we get more income, we pay a higher rate because of our tax brackets. The payroll taxes are quite the opposite. First of all, you don't pay payroll tax on anything except your earnings. So if you've got a lot of investment income, that's totally exempt from the tax. And high-income people are much more likely to have investment income than lower-income people. So by itself, the fact that we're exempting that form of income from the tax means it will be regressive. Higher income people will pay a lower share of their income. But the second thing going on is the way we tax income to pay for Social Security is limited to the first $113,700 of income this year. It was $110,000 last year, $113,000 and change this year. You pay 6.2% of your income, of that income, but only up to that cap. Above that, you don't pay any more in tax to support Social Security. We do have a tax to cover Medicare, a smaller tax, 1.45% of your income, your earnings, and that covers all your earnings. So if you're making $1 million, you can pay 1.45% of that. If you make $1,000, you can pay 1.45% of that. So that's a constant rate, but the Social Security, because it's capped, means if you're making less than that $113,000, you'll pay a full 6.2%. As your earnings go above that, that percentage will shrink as you have more and more income facing a zero tax rate. So that's regressive. The issue with Social Security, though, is let's think about the system as a whole. You're paying money in now while you're working, and you're going to draw benefits when you're retired. If you don't take those benefits into account in terms of measuring progressivity or regressivity of the entire system, you don't get the entire picture. Mm. And benefits are progressive in the Social Security system. That is, low-income people get a larger share of their earnings replaced by Social Security benefits than high-income people do, so they're benefiting more relative to income. It's a progressive benefit system that offsets, to some degree, the regressiveness of the taxes.
Do you think, and much has been made of the wealth gap in this country, do you think in part that our tax system has created, some very, very, very wealthy people, a struggling middle class, and a growing number of poor people?
I don't think the tax system has a lot to do with that. I think the tax system, in fact, does something to reverse that a little bit. I think bigger than that is the fact that we have a free market system that rewards people for doing well and penalizes people for not doing so well, or at least doesn't reward them for it. And we don't all start on equal footing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't all end up on equal footing. We don't start with the same benefits growing up. We don't come from the same kinds of families. We don't have the same educational opportunities. All sorts of reasons why opportunities determine outcomes. And then, of course, what we put into it. Some people can come from very poor backgrounds and still make out very well just through the dint of hard work and luck. Other people are born with a silver spoon and do well or not so well. But The outcomes are what matter, and I think they're mostly due to the market itself and the starting point where you you begin your life.
Is it possible to describe capital gains on the radio without a blackboard?
That's a good question.
Marty. Is it? Okay, well, give it a shot.
The answer is yes. Yes, it's easy to explain what a capital gain is. If I buy a stock for $1,000, 100 shares of stock, $10 a share, I paid $1,000. I wait 10 years. The price has gone up to $20 a share. It's now worth $2,000 for my 100 shares. I sell that. My capital gain is the difference between the $2,000 I sell it for and the $1,000 I bought it for. I have a capital gain of $1,000, and that's subject to federal income tax, but at a maximum rate of 20%.
Okay, fair enough. Again, that's Rob Williams, our guest today on Radio Times. And yes, we are talking about taxes, how our tax system works, who pays, where the money goes, who doesn't pay, how all these taxes, I guess, fit together. And again, he's a tax analyst at the nonpartisan Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. And of course, today is Tax Day. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm quoting again here from the New York Times, but they had a lot of articles over the last couple of days about our tax system. This is about GE. And I'm quoting here, GE employed more than 130,000 people in the U.S. in the year 2010. Earned $14.2 billion, $5 billion of which was generated in the United States, and yet its American tax bill for that year, as reported by the New York Times, was zero. How come?
Well, there are a couple of reasons behind that. One is, as the numbers you cited suggest, much of their income was earned overseas, and income earned by American companies overseas is not subject to U.S. tax until it's brought home, what we call repatriated earnings. Companies doing business abroad can leave money over there for a number of reasons. One is to invest more overseas, but another is to avoid the tax they'd pay if they brought it home. It's estimated that there are a couple trillion dollars of profits sitting overseas owned by American corporations that are being left there for one reason or another. But that still leaves the $5 billion that GE was cited as making in the United States. Why didn't they pay tax on that? I don't know the details of the GE's tax returns, but I suspect it has to do with losses they incurred in previous years that they're allowed to carry forward to use in a subsequent year to offset earnings. So if they lost $5 billion cumulatively over the previous 3 or 4 years, they can use that to offset the $5 billion of earnings in the particular tax year, and it shows up as zero. They can also take advantage of various tax breaks. The kinds of investment they make may give them certain deductions and exclusions, exemptions, that don't show up necessarily in that profit number, but they show up for tax purposes.
Using that as an example, and, you know, most people don't want to pay their taxes. They don't enjoy doing that. But nonetheless, do you think it feeds this belief system that the tax system is unfair and it's slanted for certain people and against other people?
I think people certainly have that perception. And one of the reasons they do is the tax system is so complicated that they feel there's something out there I should be taking advantage of that I'm not taking advantage of. Why am I paying taxes? These rich guys must be finding ways to avoid those taxes. As a result of that attitude, 60% of us hire somebody to do our taxes. They get an accountant or go to H&R Block, something like that, get somebody else to fill out the tax return, even when the tax returns aren't all that complicated, for fear of missing something that will reduce their tax bill, and also fear of making a mistake and the IRS will come after them to pay more tax. Another 30% of us use computer software to do our taxes, TurboTax or TaxAct, something like that, letting the computer figure out what our taxes are. And those kinds of programs walk through and say, do you have this kind of income? Do you have that kind of income? Have you had this kind of expense? Trying to minimize your tax bill in that way. Only 10% of us do taxes the old-fashioned way with pen and paper and fill out the tax return by hand. And a lot of that has to do with complexity and fears that the difficult tax system means we won't get all the benefits we should, that somebody else is getting. That's not a good tax system. What you'd like to have is a tax system that's very transparent. People know what their taxes are going to be. They know why their taxes are what they are. They can see in advance what the taxes will be instead of having to wait till the tail end and see what the accountant says. And a transparent tax system is much better in terms of not influencing people's behavior and not encouraging people to go looking for ways to reduce their tax bills that may skirt the edge of the law.
You had mentioned estate taxes earlier, and it's so curious because on the one hand, this really applies to just a handful of people, and yet it has gotten so much attention in the last couple of years. Do you understand that?
I don't really understand the logic behind it, although I have some ideas what might happen. We estimate that fewer than 4,000 estates will owe any federal estate tax this year. That's about less than 0.2% of all deaths will result in a taxable estate. So it's a tiny, tiny sliver of people. We've exempt the first $5.25 million of assets when you die. For a couple, it's twice that, $10.5 million. So it very few people pay it. Why do people oppose the idea of an estate tax? Well, part of it, I think, is that it's been branded a death tax.
Mm.
Here comes
the critics did.
Government collecting money from you when you die. It's a horrible time anyway. Why should the government come in and demand its pound of flesh? But beyond that, I think it's people have worked hard. They paid taxes all these years. Why should they pay another tax on their wealth when they go out? Why not just let them leave it to their heirs without having to pay anything to the federal government?
You had also mentioned that the payroll tax, and we should everyone should know that, and probably do, that on January 1st, that Social Security payroll tax went back to the 6.2%. What kind of impact, and perhaps we're even feeling it already, do you think that will have an impact on the economy and consumer spending, for instance?
Well, we estimate that means $120 billion will be pulled out of people's pockets this year compared to what they were getting last year.
Mm-hmm.
That's paychecks in total down by about $120 billion. That's about 0.1% of our GDP. It's a small fraction of GDP, but it's still, I'm sorry, it's 1% of GDP.
1%, okay.
1%, I'm sorry. My arithmetic is wrong. That's noticeable in terms of how much money people have to spend. And it's certainly going to put a damper on spending relative to what it otherwise would have been. On the other hand, it's dribs and drabs. It's coming out of people's paychecks a little bit each paycheck, about 2% of your paycheck lower. For some of us, that means we will be tightening belts. We won't be able to buy the things we want to buy. For other people, it means less saving than they otherwise would have done, but they won't change their consumption very much. In the aggregate, it's not good for a struggling economy. It's not going to help our unemployment situation. But at some point, you have to cut back on the stimulus put into the economy. The question is this too fast, too soon?
Do you think it is, or is it too soon to tell?
I think we should be focusing more in the short run on getting people back to work, getting the economy going again, rather than trying to balance our budget. We do need to worry about the budget imbalance, the fact that we've been running up very large deficits and running up our debt very rapidly over the last few years. Almost all of that is due to a weak economy. Some of it is due to the stimulus that we've been pushing into it, but we haven't put as much stimulus as a lot of people would like. There's disagreement among economists and among policymakers on how effective the kinds of stimulus we've been using can be in terms of getting the economy to grow faster. We know in the short run more spending does increase demand and increase the number of jobs. What that does in the long run, people disagree about. People like Paul Krugman in the New York Times will argue that we've done much, much too little. We should be spending more than twice as much in terms of stimulating the economy and then focus on the deficit down the road. Other people argue exactly the opposite. They say this is just putting money into an economy in an inflationary way. It doesn't create real growth, certainly doesn't create long-term lasting growth, and therefore we're just wasting money by doing that. We'd be much better off to try to balance the budget. That will encourage people to invest because they see fiscal responsibility on the part of the government, not runaway, potentially runaway inflation. Those two camps, they're very diametrically opposed views, and we're sitting somewhere in between. It's not quite the Goldilocks situation where it's not too hot, not too cold. It's somewhere in the middle. Well, it's not clear it's working well at all right now. The unemployment rate is slipping slowly downward. but we still have an awful lot of people without jobs and an awful lot of people who have been without jobs for an awfully long time.
I wonder whether we could also look to our European counterparts, who they seem to have embraced more austerity, at least so far in this country, to see how that experiment is running.
It certainly hasn't been wonderful for the European economies. So tightening the belts has not caused them to their economies to grow faster, and we're doing much, much better than virtually anyone else around the world. Yeah. Occasional countries, there are countries like Germany that have done well, but they were very strong economies to begin with and didn't suffer the same way that other European countries did. They benefited in some ways by being the strong man and the weak group. But the American economy, relative to others, has done pretty well, which is not to say it's doing well.
Right. Let me get to, looks like Kevin from Allentown to join our conversation. And Kevin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, my name is Kevin. I am a business student at Clarkson University in upstate New York. I was just calling because while I was listening to your discussion of progressive and regressive taxes, I was wondering what is so wrong, or what's the reason that we don't have a flat tax rate for federal income taxes?
A flat tax rate.
Right. Yes, yes.
Bob, go ahead. Yeah.
There are a lot of people who would like to see a flat tax rate, and the issue comes down to one of what your perception of fairness is. One view is paying the same percentage of your income for everyone is a fair way to do it. Everybody's having some sort of equal sacrifice. But the opposing argument to that in favor of progressive taxes says a dollar to a rich man is worth a lot less than a dollar to a poor man. And as a result, if we tax the same percentage of income, then we're really hitting the poor man harder in terms of how much worse off you're making him in the scheme of things. If that's the perception, then you should be taking a larger share of income from the rich guy because he doesn't value the dollar as much. He's not going to be hurt as much by the tax than you take from the poor man. Hmm. It doesn't work necessarily for the individual because some people, very rich people, might value those dollars very, very great. We know Scrooge McDuff loves to swim in his dollars.
Yes, he does.
So there's some people who very rich to value those dollars, but on the whole, the perception is that low-income people need their dollars a lot more than high-income people do, and therefore the fair thing to do, based on ability to pay, is to tax high-income people at a larger percentage.
Kevin, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Bob, we're about a minute away from our second break here, but from your vantage point and with all your years looking at our tax code, do you have ideas about how to simplify it and make it at least feel more fair?
I think the problem with doing them is, first of all, there are lots of things I would do, and I can go one by one through the different aspects of the tax code, but that's really the way we need to do it. Right. We need to go one by one through provisions, say, what is this provision doing? What is it we intending it to do? Is it meeting that goal? An example would be the mortgage interest rate. Why do we have the mortgage interest deduction? Why do we allow people to deduct that? How does it affect the housing market? Is that what we wanted to do? And I'd be happy to spend time after the break going through that in detail if people want, or talk about any of those. There's no single size fits all for how to fix the tax code, but it is a matter of going through and asking for each provision, is this what we want? Is it do what we want the way we want to do it?
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Robertson Williams. He's a tax analyst at the nonpartisan Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He spent a bunch of years at the Congressional Budget Office from 1984 through 2006. This being tax day, we thought we would call him up and ask him to join us on Radio Times to talk about our complex tax system and to take calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Sony Classics, The Company You Keep, a new thriller directed by and starring Robert Redford, with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon, about one man's journey to outrun the FBI and his radical past, starts Friday.
PA Wine and Spirits Premium Collection Stores support WHYY. Chairman Selection Wines offer a collection of varietals and vintages chosen by wine professionals. Signs bearing the Chairman Selection seal can assist customers in choosing a fine bottle of wine. New selections arrive regularly in PA Wine and Spirits Premium Collection Stores and online at finewineandgoodspirits.com. PA Wine and Spirits Premium Collection Stores support WHYY.
Most baseball fans joke about baseball as a religion, but if you look at it closely, there is significant overlap. Faith and doubt, miracles, blessings and curses, and community. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, exploring the connections between America's so-called favorite pastime and religion with John Sexton, author of Baseball as a Road to God, today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Widener supports WHYY. A graduate degree from Widener University is designed to help be the difference in your career. Widener University offers graduate degrees in programs including allied health studies, nursing, and more. Registration at widener.edu/graduate.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about our tax system today in Radio Times with Bob Williams and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Richard from West Philadelphia to join us. Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. There's one thing that seems to be left out of the conversation. If you take the federal revenue from personal income tax and subtract the federal outlays from paying out tax credits, it appears that the revenue from social insurance contributions is greater than the revenue from personal income tax.
Is that true, Bob?
Well, I think, if I understand Richard's comment accurately, that if you take the amount of tax people pay and take out the preferences built into it, correct me on this, Richard, if you can.
Okay.
You want to pull out the piece that's essentially giving money back to people.
There are outlays in the budget for...
The outlay... I guess I'm failing to understand the question. In terms of revenues raised, the federal income tax raises somewhat more money than the payroll tax, but not a lot more. Those are the two major sources of federal revenue. Each collects something on the order of 42-43% of all federal revenues. Last couple of years, the income taxes run ahead because we had the payroll tax cut. But on the whole, they're running neck and neck these days. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we give people tax breaks in the income tax that lowers their tax bills from what they otherwise would be. We estimate that federal income tax revenues are more than $1 trillion lower because of all the tax breaks. If you took all the tax preferences out of the system, people would not get that $1 trillion in tax savings, and our revenues would be substantially larger. And that's the kind of spending through the tax code that is a policy decision. We've decided to do a lot of social policy, a lot of business policy through the tax code, which mucks it up and means it's not just for raising revenue.
Richard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And picking up on that, and also picking up on what you said about the mortgage deduction, wondering whether things like charitable deductions and the deduction people get if they get their health care benefits at work, all these you think should be at least analyzed and decide, do we want to keep this? Is this good for our current economy? Is it fair?
Well, let me contrast the two that you've mentioned, one, the mortgage interest deduction and the charitable contributions deduction. The way the mortgage interest deduction works is a little bizarre. Let me describe it as if it were a spending program. We're going to encourage people to buy houses by subsidizing their mortgages. If you buy a big house with a big mortgage, we're going to subsidize that big mortgage. If you buy a small house with a small mortgage, we're going to subsidize a little mortgage. And if you're a rich guy in the top tax bracket, we're going to pay 40% of your mortgage interest. If you're a little guy with that smaller mortgage in a low tax bracket, we're going to pay 10 or 15% of your mortgage interest.
Right.
That, as a spending program, sounds really dumb. Why are we paying 40% of the rich guy's mortgage and only 10 or 15% of the poor guy's mortgage? But that's exactly how it works in our tax code, because the benefit is a function of your tax rate. If you're in a high tax bracket, you save a lot by deducting that amount of spending. Low tax rate, you're not. And here we're subsidizing personal consumption. Contrast that with the charitable contribution. There, you're giving away money to causes that the federal government has deemed good causes. These are charitable activities that the government thinks is appropriate, and that reduces your ability to pay. You've got less money in your own pocket. Your ability to pay taxes is lower. You shouldn't pay tax on that, as if you'd never gotten the income in the first place. So there's an argument for allowing a deduction there. It makes a lot more sense. As long as you buy the assumption that these are good good causes that should be charitable. A lot of things we can deduct on our income tax are not necessarily fitting that. For example, I give money to my alma mater to support the football team. Is that a charitable contribution, or is that something that I get huge benefit out of having a good football team with the alma mater?
Well, and they get benefits as well because they're called a charitable institution by the government.
That's right. Now, it may be fine to do it if we're subsidizing scholarships for low-income students. That sounds a lot more charitable than making sure my football team is very good. there's lots of interesting questions here. But just the contrasting the mortgage interest versus charitable contributions, one can say, they're very different, and they might be treated differently.
Let me see what Susan from Fort Washington has to say. Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I have a question about college education and for middle and upper income. As the cost of colleges get higher and higher, middle and upper incomes don't qualify for financial aid, and yet we don't get any education credits as well. Do you see that as changing at all in the future?
What do you think, Bob?
I think the likelihood of expanding tax benefits is going to be relatively low in the future, just because we need the revenues, and expanding ways in which we reduce people's taxes is less likely to be on the table than ways of raising or maintaining the revenue we've got right now. But I'm just guessing along those lines. It certainly does feel like you could use a tax break when you're paying those big tuition bills. I can tell you from experience.
Indeed. Susan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Bob, I'm curious about the Affordable Care Act, which is being rolled out over these couple of years. How do you see that playing out in our tax system?
Well, one thing that we know is going to happen this year is high-income people will be hit with new taxes. The Affordable Care Act, or ACA, imposes two new taxes on incomes for people with very high incomes, or shouldn't say very high, couples with incomes over $250,000, singles with incomes over $200,000. One tax they'll pay is any earnings above those thresholds will face an additional 0.9% tax, a slightly less than 1% tax, on the earnings. So if combined husband and wife are earning $300,000 a year, that last $50,000, the part over the 250 threshold, will be facing this new tax, about 1%. The second tax is a tax on unearned income, and it equals 3.8% of investment income above those thresholds. So high-income people, that top 400 that have very, very high incomes and are not paying very high taxes, for example, will pay a new tax, 3.8% of the investment income above those thresholds. Those combined will pull a lot of money out of very wealthy people's pockets, not affecting the rest of us, and that will help support the ACA.
Let me ask you about what sometimes looks like a marriage benefit and then it sometimes looks like a marriage penalty. And I'm also thinking of DOMA, that if and I realize that that would take time, assuming it's overturned to flesh out across the states. But help us understand the thinking, I guess, behind what could be either a marriage penalty or a marriage benefit.
Well, the marriage situation is very complex and hard to explain sometimes. It has very long roots, dating back to 1930.
Wow.
Supreme Court decisions then saying that couples had to file individual taxes unless they were in community property states, so the nine states that say you combine your incomes and split them evenly. that meant that people, couples in community property states could benefit from income splitting, which essentially became a marriage bonus for those people in those states. World War II, when the income tax went from being a class tax paid by 4 or 5% of the population to a mass tax being paid by about two-thirds of the population, made it a bigger issue. And states after World War II started saying, well, for tax purposes, we'll be community property states and let people split their incomes and pay lower taxes. So in 1948, the Congress created the married filing jointly tax status. You could file as a couple, effectively splitting your income and paying lower taxes, and that created marriage bonuses for most couples. Fine and dandy, everything was great for a while. Single people didn't seem to notice that they were paying relatively higher taxes, that there was a singles penalty, because what's a marriage bonus becomes a singles penalty, until the 60s when some war widows, World War II widows, started recognizing that, hey, wait a minute, we're paying more tax. We would be married except our husbands were sacrificed for the good of the country, and now you're charging us more taxes, single people, than we would if we were still being married.
Huh.
Got to do something about that. Well, Congress then said, okay, we're going to solve the problem by splitting the baby in half. We'll raise the tax a little bit on the couples, lower the tax a little bit on the single people, and that created marriage penalties for some couples. So from that point until now, we have this mixture. Some people benefit from being married, typically people who where the spouses have very different incomes, mm-hmm. and some people get marriage penalties for being married, typically people whose income or the spouses' incomes are about the same. And that, of course, has implications for same-sex marriages. If you can't be married, then you can't get advantage of marriage bonuses, nor can you be penalized by marriage penalties.
A fascinating story, though, to sort of see how it started and where we stand today.
Nobody likes it, but it's where it is.
It's where it is, and perhaps something that, again, that should be looked at. Let me see what Steve from Haverton has to say. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
I wanted to ask you a question about, it's really a transparency issue. I'm one of those 10% who prepare taxes the old-fashioned way, and it takes a fair amount of time to do that. But in doing it, I find that I become extremely knowledgeable about the kinds of things that we tax in our country. And when I talk to friends who do their taxes the newer ways, there seems to be a greater level of ignorance about what's actually going on in our tax system. And so I wonder if 90% of the nation is using some alternative method, how transparent is our system, really, and how knowledgeable are we about it?
That's fascinating. Steve, let me ask you, why do you do your own taxes? Is it you just want to stay knowledgeable?
That's partly it. Over the past several years, I've just had some unique situations dealing with adoption credits and some other things that have helped me to discover that there are a lot of judgment calls in completing one's taxes, and I don't necessarily trust a computer program to do those well.
Oh, that's. Let me see what Bob Williams has to say. What do you think, Bob?
I think Steve's absolutely right that this does harm the transparency of the system. Part of the problem with transparency is the complications. You really do have to get down on the nuts and bolts the way you're doing, Steve, when you do your own taxes. And people who use computer software don't necessarily understand at all what's going on behind it. People who go to accountants, unless they sit down with the accountant and say, explain this to me, and the accountant doesn't want to take the time to do that, they're not going to understand. So 90% of us really do have this very narrow, shallow understanding of what our taxes are. I use TurboTax. I've been doing that for a number of years just because it's a lot easier to fill out the forms that way. And if I make a mistake, I can go back and correct it easily. But at the end of the day, I take a look at my tax return, and for me, who's been doing this as a professional for years and years and years, it's still hard sometimes to figure out why did the number turn out what it did. I have to dig back in the same way you do, Steve, when you're trying to figure out what are you going to pay. And most people don't do that. Most people don't understand. They don't necessarily get the full benefits of the system. They don't get all the advantage they could. And as you say, interpretation really matters. Every few years, someone in the media goes out and gives the same tax story to 15 or 20 different accountants, and they get 15 or 20 different tax bills because there's interpretation this way, there's interpretation that way. You don't get the same answer all the time.
Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Wayne from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Wayne, you're on the air. Go ahead.
First of all, let me just say you're excellent in this explanation of a very difficult topic. You really are. It's fabulous.
That's great.
Thank you.
My question really has to do more of in a comprehensive way. We talk about taxing the wealthy in the country, and you know whatever that means to certain people. Clearly, a billionaire is wealthy, if you will. And then we use an income denomination of $250,000, which is another level. It's income; it's not necessarily wealth. And we actually have people in the country who work for, let's say, the federal government, who don't make $200,000 or $250,000. and yet really are millionaires when you take into consideration they have a defined benefit pension program and post-retirement health insurance, all of which will continue on to, what, 84 or 78, mm-hmm. whatever you want to use as a life expectancy, and they're not paying any higher tax. That would clearly be considered wealth. So it confuses me when I hear tax the millionaires and the billionaires, and then immediately we use an income level, which somebody making $250 could be far from being worth $1 million or more.
Well, Wayne, that's a good call, and let me see what Bob Williams has to say. Bob, your thoughts?
I think even more of an issue is the fact that $250,000 isn't the same amount of income in different parts of the country. Try living in New York City in Manhattan on $250,000 versus living in a small town in rural somewhere. $250,000 just doesn't go as far if you have high costs for housing and for all the things you have to buy. So, and we don't make any corrections for that. $250,000 is the same as far as the tax man's concerned, regardless of where you live. We do make some adjustment for things like taxes you pay and so forth with deductions, but on the whole, we don't correct for that. And we don't correct for wealth and the kinds of wealth built up in retirement. We allow people to defer taxes on those things, and that's the same thing done with the wealth being built up in a retirement account that's a defined benefit plan, like the pensions you're describing, or the wealth we build up in our IRAs and our 401ks that are, again, deferred taxes. Once we draw them out, we pay taxes. So those federal workers you're talking about will pay taxes later on. But the deferral is worth an awful lot in terms of not having to pay now and paying later.
Wayne, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Bob, we're almost out of time here. Do you think there is an appetite in Washington, whether from the White House or from Congress itself, to take a hard and close look at our tax system?
I think that there's a general recognition that the tax system is very complicated right now, and a simpler, more transparent system would be better all around. We'd like to know how much the tax system retards economic growth. One of the arguments on the Republican side for cutting tax rates is that people aren't investing as much as they would. They're not starting new businesses. They're not creating jobs because taxes are too high or are levied in ways that are not very efficient. And if we could get rates down, we do more on the job creation front. On the other side of the aisle, there's a recognition that if we want to spend the kind of money we want to spend, then we're going to have to collect more revenue, and they're looking for ways to do that, but they want to do it in ways that won't hurt the economy. And we've got two very different views that are really hard to reconcile.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times on Tax Day. Bob Williams, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure, Marty.
And he's with the nonpartisan Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, but stay with us. We'll be right back.